culture to politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. Another great week, in fact, where everybody is deeply concerned about the question of personal safety and domestic security. Why? Well, 53 shootings over the weekend in Chicago. A mayor's race in New York that is almost certainly going to turn on the issue of rising crime and personal security. And because the Biden administration has refused to back down on the contention that the greatest threat to domestic security right now is white supremacist, far-right, extremist organizations like those that attacked the Capitol building on January 6th. Is that true? I'm not sure at all that Chad Wolf, who was a former acting secretary of Homeland Security, cabinet member, in fact, acting cabinet member, who previously had served in several positions in DHS, including as chief of staff of the Transportation Security Administration and chief of staff to the DHS secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen. Right now, Chad Wolf is with the America First Policy Institute. Mr. Wolf, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Is the president and his team, are they right that we have a grave threat, our most grave threat right now, with domestic extremists?
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate being here this afternoon. And overall, look, I would say that when we look at domestic extremists, we need to be eyes wide open about the threat that they pose here to the homeland. But I would contend that the president is not being honest with the American people. We have many threats facing the homeland, and the threat from white supremacy is just one. But it's certainly not the largest threat or the most concerning threat at the moment. We have cybersecurity risk and threats to Americans every single day. Threats from foreign terrorist organizations, natural disasters, pandemics. There's a variety of threats facing the homeland, and this idea that white supremacy is at the very, very top of that list is just not backed up by any data.
Okay, I think there are a lot of people who would agree with you on that, but in terms of addressing the whole question of Homeland Security, which was once your job in the Trump administration cabinet, what is the most immediate priority that needs to change?
Well, I got asked that question a lot. What's the highest threat facing the homeland? It's hard to argue because there's different threats to different sectors of the economy and to the homeland writ large. So if you're in California, wildfires certainly concern you a lot, or if you're in the Gulf Coast during hurricane season, those concern you. But what I can tell you is obviously cybersecurity, the threat from China, these are things that as I was leaving the department, we were most concerned about in the long term. Cybersecurity is actually here in the short term. But the threat posed by malign Chinese influence and actions here in the homeland are greatly concerning to me. And I would say overall, just the foreign terrorist threat to the homeland, it's been there since 9/11. It'll continue to be there. We need to continue to guard against that and put in counterterrorism measures that protect the homeland and that protect Americans every single day.
A lot of people would say that by pulling out of Afghanistan, as we are doing, that was a policy initiated by President Trump and one of the few President Trump policies that has been followed up by President Biden, that by handing basically control of Afghanistan over to the Taliban, we're only encouraging foreign terrorism. Do you think there's an argument that can be made for that?
I think that's certainly something to watch out for. I think the idea there is that as you pull out of places like Afghanistan, do you allow it to become a safe haven for terrorists to come together and then to plan certain attacks against America or our allies? And I think that's, again, something that we're going to need to watch for. We're going to make sure that that doesn't occur in the long run. Now, do you need American troops in country to do that, or can you accomplish that same objective a different way? I think that's what's going to be incumbent upon the Biden administration to make sure that as we withdraw U.S. troops, that we're not encouraging, our adversaries to be able to come together to plan attacks in the homeland. We've got to be able to disrupt those those plans and those activities another way.
And what about, I mean, one of the things that's very striking is people are obviously very concerned about the surging murder rate that we have in the country, the surging rate of violence and rape and personal insecurity. But we lose more people to drug overdoses than we do to suicide and murder combined, and far more. Do we need to do more to try to limit the damage of so-called recreational drugs?
Well, I think you put really, you know, hit on a good subject, which is the 70,000 or so overdose deaths from illegal narcotics that we see every year. Almost all of those drugs, but not exclusively all, are coming across that southwest border. So Mexican cartels and transnational criminal organizations are certainly a threat to everyday Americans, and we see that just in the number of deaths. So we need to tackle this problem, whether addressing the actual drugs and the categories of those drugs, or whether we're taking more aggressive action against those cartels and the deadly trade that they are operating, which ties back to border security that we see along that southwest border. They're all tied together, and you've got to address it. You can't just address it on one front. You've got to attack it across the board. And I would say that the most concerning thing right now is that the Biden administration and the policies from this administration are actually fueling that crisis. Cartels are making millions of dollars every single day on the number of individuals that they are smuggling across the border in numbers that we've never seen before. So the administration needs to get serious about the crisis on the southwest border, because it has an effect also on the illegal narcotics.
Now, you were there at DHS, and you were dealing with all of this. Do you think it's correct perception that the current president of Mexico, AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is less determined to cut back on the power of the cartels than his predecessor, President Nieto? And what do we do about that, given the fact that AMLO seems to be very popular despite the cartels?
Yeah, it's a difficult subject. The Mexican government is always going to be somewhat tied to those cartels, and I think they're going to have limited amount of effect. But that's not to say that the U.S. government shouldn't continue to push Mexico to do more. And that's what we did under President Trump. And if that's withholding funding, if that's doing a number of things, it's important to keep the pressure on them because they need to take action there. And then there's other things that the U.S. government can do to help them and support them in doing that. But absolutely, it should be a focus. It should be a number one focus for the U.S. government to attack the cartels. And when I say attack, is really to address them any number of ways, whether that's direct assistance to the Mexican government, direct action against those cartels, cyber action against the cartels. There's a variety of different things that we can do that we need to really take the gloves off, because, again, as I indicated, those cartels are responsible not only for the thousands and millions at this point of migrants coming across that border, but illegal narcotics and other illegal contraband is killing Americans every day.
Well, again, I think that when you look at the role of coyotes, the role of paid smugglers and human traffickers, which is what they really are, that should be able to be a bipartisan issue, no? I mean, that you've got to crack down on the people who are exploiting human beings and destroying lives. By ruthlessly trying to make money by smuggle them across the border?
Well, it certainly should be, and I think most leaders in Washington will say that we need to address that, but sort of the proof is in the pudding. And when it comes down to actions, what I've seen again from this administration, unfortunately, is that the actions that they're taking along that border are not dissuading cartels and others from this human trafficking chain that they have created, but is in fact encouraging it.
Okay, let us hope for better. Some information about Chad Wolf's work, both during the Trump administration and afterward, is featured on our website at michaelmedved.com. When we come back, more on the crime issue and why it does appear to be catching hold. We'll be right back on the Medved Show. And speaking of national security and border security and more, there's an interesting report about a Democratic congressman whose name is Donald Payne Jr. He represents the 10th district of the Garden State of New Jersey. And what it reports in the New Jersey Globe, wearing a skimpy Captain America T-shirt and boxer shorts and sitting next to his unmade bed, Representative Donald Payne Jr., Democrat, New Jersey, attended an early morning virtual hearing of the U.S. House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee. Does it make you feel good that our security is in such firm hands? And then there's this, and I actually kind of love to see this, because one of the most self-righteous and obnoxious of the very liberal Democrats in the U.S. Senate is Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. Very extraordinarily contemptuous of anyone on the other side. Well, it turns out that they're reporting that Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island continues to defend his family's membership in the private Bailey's Beach Club in Newport. Very exclusive, prestigious private club. Also a private club that is all white. Can you imagine if a U.S. senator who had an R after his name continued to maintain membership in a whites-only club? What do you think the reaction would be? My guess is it might be just a bit indignant. And then there is the issue of more serious crimes, and they are deeply serious. And listen to the CNN story on what is going on in San Francisco, almost without meaningful opposition. Listen to the, everybody saw the video showing the individual coming in on a bike and then taking things off the shelf and putting them in a big black garbage bag and then riding out on his bike while the basically the security guard kind of waved at him. This is clip 5A. Listen.
The viral video captured by local ABC reporter Leanne Melendez laid bare the lawlessness, further eroding the image of one of America's most beloved cities.
I live in the city, and I see this constantly.
Indeed, it has happened so constantly that Walgreens says it has shuttered 17 of its stores in San Francisco over the past 5 years, mainly due to theft.
When you see the amount of theft in San Francisco versus some of our average stores in the company, that multiplier factor is really driven by the organized retail crime.
A Walgreens executive telling elected supervisors last month that theft here is four times the national average, driven by organized crime rings. CBS says it's experiencing a similar surge. The city has yet to come up with an effective solution.
This has been out of control, and people are scared to go into these stores, seniors, people with disabilities, children, and it's just happening brazenly.
And with few consequences. According to police data, less than 3% of theft cases this year have netted an arrest, which some believe only invites more criminal behavior.
It's amazing. Amazing. And actually, 2.8% of these crimes have produced an arrest. And there's a core issue involved here, which even CNN, again, it recognizes without much hesitation. This is 5B.
Ultimately, we do need more police officers, and it's important to make sure that we have the sufficient staff to walk the beat. There's no easy solution to this.
I feel like the theft is outrageous, and it's obvious that people are taking advantage of the fact that there's zero consequences.
For business owners like Adam Mesnick, who has been documenting the city's woes, the chronic theft just adds to the despair being felt on the streets, aggravated even more by the pandemic. Visible homelessness surging as shelters thinned out due to the virus. Open-air drug use and dealing common. Last year, overdoses, mainly from fentanyl, resulting in a record 712 deaths, according to city data, more than doubling those who died of COVID.
There's a high amount of crime, safety concerns, and the quality of life has seemed to shrink tremendously.
Yeah, and most dramatically of all, shrinking with the homeless everywhere on the street. And all of this is connected. And that's something that, honestly people have to acknowledge. It's the old argument about the broken windows effect. Why do broken windows that don't get repaired cause crime? They do. Because they send a message to potential criminals. There's no order here. There's no consequence to anything you do. If people are sleeping on the street corner and sleeping in parks and everywhere else, if garbage is accumulating, then it looks like an entire social breakdown where you can get away with the kind of theft that they're talking about in San Francisco. Of course, it's not just San Francisco. A CBS in Texas, Waco, Texas, reports on crime in Austin, related very directly to some city council decisions. This is CBS. Listen.
Meanwhile, law enforcement in Austin are worried what happened this past weekend is only a taste of what the rest of the summer could look like. As the city council begins tackling next year's budget, police will push for it to reverse course on a plan to reduce funding.
Crime has been rising in Austin.
Greater Austin Crime Commission Executive Director Kerry Roberts fears the mass shooting this weekend is just a preview of what's to come this summer.
People who for more than a year have been limited in their social interactions are going to want to get out.
On top of the 13 people hurt and one dead from the mass shooting early Saturday morning, there were three other shootings over the weekend. Two other people were killed in shootings, a woman in North Austin and a man in Southeast Austin. Just three blocks away from the deadly Southeast Austin shooting, two more women were shot and went to the hospital. The violence has put the halting of cadet classes and budget cuts to APD under a microscope. Even though officials said they were fully staffed at the time of the mass shooting downtown, they have trouble filling those shifts.
What we asked the city council to do last summer was to not make these changes without understanding the unintended consequences of it. They cut 150 positions out of the police department. We now have 140 more additional vacancies.
Okay, this is extraordinary. And again, it should not be beyond our control. There are reasons, of course, to celebrate the fact that we are coming out of the pandemic. There's still too many people are getting sick and still too many people are dying. And yes, everybody needs to get vaccinated. However, compare the situation we have now with the situation that applied a year ago. And it's a tremendous improvement. And today, by the way, we had a gigantic day on Wall Street. Stocks up almost 600 points, 586. So what is going on? How do you explain the huge surge in crime other than idiotic policies that need, I repeat, need to be changed immediately? We'll talk about how and why coming up on The MedVed Show. Michael Medved Show, I do believe it's a great country. I believe we have a great future. I believe there are reasons to feel encouraged about our future. But there are many, many people in this country, including an overwhelming majority of Republicans, who believe that morally America is declining, that we are getting worse. We are not getting better. And part of that, it seems to me, has to do with the idea of crime and destruction and property destruction and violence and no consequences. Dateline from NBC News. Charges have been dropped for hundreds of alleged looters in New York City. The quote from Jessica Betancourt, whose Bronx eyeglass shop was looted last June, a year ago. She says, I was in total shock that everything is being brushed off to the side. And then there's this headline, most charges dropped against protesters in Miami. Dozens who participated in protests for George Floyd were arrested in Miami. And NBC6 investigators found most of those charges have been dropped a year since the protests began. In Spokane, most people arrested at last year's protest turned riot. In downtown Spokane, Spokane, Washington, a lovely city actually, but really? In Spokane, which is not one of the liberal hotbeds, it's one of the more conservative centers in the state of Washington, that most people arrested for a riot had charges dropped? What is the thinking in this? I mean, you expect it in Portland, and unfortunately you expect it of the absolutely worst in the nation city attorney in Seattle, Pete Holmes. And who, it's just a despicable thing. If you are ruining somebody's store, somebody who has a small eyeglass shop, you're damaging their life in a serious way. And damaging whole neighborhoods, and we're talking about the broken windows effect, and encouraging more and more and more crime, which we are getting. Listen to the latest from Atlanta. This is clip number 10 from Inside Edition.
Another city that has been rocked by rising crime is Atlanta. One area of the city in particular has seen more than a 50% rise in violent assaults this year. So some residents actually want to organize a secession from the rest of Atlanta. Les Trent has our report.
A jogger cries out for help. He's just been shot twice in Atlanta's wealthiest enclave, Buckhead.
Somebody just shot me.
And is there any serious bleeding?
Yes, I'm bleeding. I've been shot.
The father of three was out for a Saturday morning jog when he says a car pulled up. He thought to ask for directions. Instead, he was stunned to see the driver had a gun.
Before he even could think, the guy shot him. And he was stunned, and he shot him again.
Ann World's husband, Andrew, was shot in the hip and leg. Fortunately, he survived and is now recovering with the help of a walker. It's just the latest in a crime wave plaguing the wealthy neighborhood, which is frequently featured on the reality show Real Housewives of Atlanta. Now, the recent crime wave is triggering calls for secession from the city so that Buckhead can create its own police force.
It is truly a war zone.
Okay, for the city of Atlanta, why would they not let Buckhead go? I know. They want to go after all of the property taxes for some of those truly beautiful mansions that they have in Buckhead. And it's not all like that in Buckhead. I've spent time there. But there are some beautiful homes, and it's a very leafy neighborhood. It's a very pleasant neighborhood. If there basically is a total breakdown in Buckhead, what is the point of defending what is going on? Cuts in policing. They're going to have a new mayor in Atlanta, and it could be even it could be easily worse. And then Lakeisha Bottoms, who is leaving the mayoralty. And speaking of leaving the mayoralty, thank goodness Bill de Blasio is going away, and Andrew Yang, who is one of the three front runners for mayor of New York, Eric Adams, a former police lieutenant, and Catherine Garcia, former commissioner of sanitation, are the others. Andrew Yang, who ran for president, gave a very solid answer, it seems to me, that has gotten him into all kinds of trouble with the liberal establishment. He gave a very solid answer on the issue of homelessness, crime, and mental illness, which of course are associated. This is clip four.
The fact is, mentally ill, homeless men are changing the character of our neighborhoods. A woman, my wife Evelyn is friends with in her mom group in Hell's Kitchen, was punched in the face by a mentally ill man, sent a picture of a bruised face around the mom group, spread like wildfire. This is happening in New York City, and we're not talking enough about it. Families are leaving as a result. In East Harlem, the neighborhood has been changed. Upper West Side, the neighborhood has been changed. We owe our people and our families better than this, and I'm frustrated by the political nature of these responses. I mean, we're not talking about housing affordability. We're talking about the hundreds of mentally ill people we all see around us every day on the streets and the subways. We need to get them off of our streets and our subways into a better environment. And when you ask what I'm going to do differently, I'm going to rebuild the stock of psych beds in our city, because the number's gone down 14%. It should be going up 100% until there are resources necessary for anyone who's mentally ill to not be on our streets. It's not right for them. It's not right for our city. There will be no recovery until we resolve this. I will fix this, New York. Yes, mentally ill people have rights, but you know who else have rights? We do. The people and families of the city. We have the right to walk the street and not fear for our safety because a mentally ill person is going to lash out at us.
Okay, he was criticized by his opponents, and of course there are dozens of them, for demonizing mentally ill people. But for goodness sake, having just been in New York for 6 days with our daughter and thinking about our daughter all the time, our oldest daughter, you know, they've had so many issues this year of people pushing people in front of subways. Why? Because they're crazy. And the one point that Andrew Yang seems to be making between the lines is, okay, yes, mentally ill people need help, but before they can get help, they need to be off the streets. And there needs to be protection for the people of the city. Look, I will tell you, walking around New York, and we had one day in New York with our daughter where we walked a total of about 13 miles. We walked a lot, and we walked all the way up from the Upper West Side, all the way down to the edge of Chinatown. It's a long walk. And they fixed up the High Line beautifully. The Riverside Park has been beautifully fixed up. The city, in some regards, is looking good. And they don't have the huge visible encampments that you have in Seattle or Portland or Los Angeles. However, you have psychos who are causing damage. And the idea of simply taking that as a cost of modern urban life is ridiculous, and it's inappropriate. News from Fox TV in North Carolina, in Charlotte, the biggest city in North Carolina. Charlotte City Council member says he has no regrets after his comments about the city's homeless population caused outrage. During the city council meeting, Councilman Tariq Bokhari suggested that when people give money or food to homeless individuals instead of charities and organizations, they are causing more harm than good. People aren't getting it, and they're still bringing food and clothing and resources directly to folks that are out there right now. They're only making themselves feel good, said Bokhari. Perhaps we explore making that a misdemeanor, he said, referring to giving money directly to homeless on the streets. This Friday, Bokhari told Fox 46 he didn't regret his words even one bit. Instead, he said he was urging city leaders to create bold strategies to end homelessness. I do think he makes sense, and we need to make sense. Or the American Renaissance that David Brooks is predicting is just not going to happen. We'll get to that and more coming up on the MedVet Show. And on the Michael MedVet Show, on a day like today when the stock market just soars, which is a very good thing. I mean, it's good for the whole country. The Standard & Poor's, the S&P 500 up 58. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 587. I mean, come on, this is good times. And you can be part of that and more with a very minor investment by going to our crowd. Finding out about the high-tech revolution, about the startup nation, which is Israel, and some of what is being achieved there, and some of what is being achieved in cooperation with operations here in the United States. Remarkable developments, things like salinization of water and conserving electricity and medical devices of all kind. There are companies in which you can be part of this crowdsourcing, crowdfunding. I was just talking to my brother, who has been the longtime founder and CEO of this company, my brother Jonathan Medved. You can look him up. He is a very solid guy, and this is a remarkable opportunity. Costs you nothing. Go to michaelmedved.com, click on the banner for Our Crowd, and find out part of what's going on in the larger economy and part of how it can make a real difference for you. Our Crowd at michaelmedved.com. We were talking about basically this idea that, well, we have an American renaissance in prospect, but what is going to block it? What's going to block it is just the inability of political leadership to live up to some of its responsibilities. And it's one of those things, and I keep referring to our week of travel last week. I did three shows, but basically the traveling was very informative for me because we spent some time walking around Brooklyn, and the parks in Brooklyn, New York are in better shape, less litter, certainly less homeless encampments, less property destruction than in Seattle. I hate to say it. And that's under Mayor de Blasio, for goodness sake. We went to the Brooklyn Botanical Garden. And again, the invasion of public spaces by people who decide they want to camp there and have no concern for anyone else, it's completely outrageous. And this North Carolina councilman, whose name is Tariq Bokhari, I think is exactly right. Why do you want to encourage people to encourage other people to live on the streets? Make it easier for them to survive with money and all kinds of help to survive doing what? Making any progress toward civilized society? No. Simply perpetuating this ugly festering sore on the nation, and it's everywhere, and it's completely outrageous. There's a someone in Charlotte, North Carolina, whose name is Woolard, Deborah Woolard. She is the founder of a charity called Block Love Charlotte. And she says, who are we to say don't give to this person when clearly we can see a need here? And she says the councilman's words were harmful. She says, I saw the same people every day, and instead of just assuming what their issues were, I would have conversations, find out what they needed. To provide people with what they need to continue living on the streets is not doing them or doing society a favor. Let us go to Sid in Atlanta. Sid, you're on the Medved Show.
Mr. Medved, how you doing? I love your show.
Thank you, and I appreciate your listening. Glad you could call.
Hey, I disagree with you a lot, but, you know, you are kind of like my teacher, you know. I learn a lot from you. But,
I appreciate it.
I've been listening to your show ever since forever. And I hear other talk show hosts, but, you know, yours is particularly my favorite, and I already say that. But you, particularly, I don't know what's up with you when it comes to homeless people. You know, I was a homeless, talented graffiti artist. I'm lying to you. My name is not Kara S1, but let me tell you that there's a lot of crimes going on in the country. And I don't hear homeless people doing anything. They are homeless. They're on drugs. They're the most desperate. I mean, they're doing real bad. But yet, they're statistically, they are not It, I know it bothers you. They look bad. They make plays.
No, it's
bad,
not just that they look bad. Sid, the case that I'm trying to make, and you'll understand it in a moment, I know you will, is that if you go into certain neighborhoods, the reason those neighborhoods become unsafe is because they look unsafe. They feel unsafe. If you have a bunch of people living in an empty lot somewhere, that's not a safe place to walk around, not because necessarily the people who are spaced out on drugs and lying in their own dirt are the ones who are going to attack you. It's because there are other people who are going to attack you and attack them. Look, I am not saying that homeless victims are guilty or they need to be thrown in prison for being homeless. But I am saying that they need to follow the same kind of rules that you would try to impose for other people.
They can't do that, Michael.
Why can't they?
They can't do that. They are, you know, they're following rules. These people are trying to get a couple of dollars, get something to eat, or, you know, for their drugs, and they are some other things. You know, I live in New York City, and my block back in the days was on 60 Minutes because of crimes and things like that. And homelessness. I see a lot of homeless people, and you know, but they never really did anything. You never hear the homeless people doing anything.
Okay. You know, the problem is right now in Seattle, and you've heard me talk about this story, I'm sure. We have at an elementary school, a K through 12 school, there is a homeless encampment with more than 50 tents. And they have prostitution going on. This is with students. This is at a school. And when you say they don't really do anything, well, that's the point. And you're not really helping them to make it easier for them to continue there. Look, right now, they have so many programs. They have programs where they took people during the pandemic and put them in hotels. They have a program here in Seattle where they allow homeless people who are chronic alcoholics to live for free and to continue drinking. And the point is, helping people to change, I think, is a genuine charity and a good thing and a loving thing to do. And it's ultimately what's going to change here. But simply encouraging people to put up tents and making them the object of pity because of their victimhood, I don't think is helping anybody. And
Let me tell you that there used to be homeless people before technology, they were our GPS. If they're standing around the corner, yes, and you lost, that's the people you go to see. Some of them are very, very helpful just for a couple of dollars. Without having to commit crimes and things like that. So, I mean, Michael, you're a good man. You know, you're in your neighborhood yourself. You know, I can't.
I do. But let me ask you. Let me ask you this, Sid, and it's a basic thing. If you get instructions on how to go somewhere and you give $5 to a homeless person, how are you helping him?
I'm thinking about his stomach. I'm thinking about, you know what, God said give. There's times that I know you give to a corporation or something like that, but there's time that I don't think about whether this person is trying to use it on drugs or whatever. It's just I got a couple of dollars that I know I'm not going to need. Here, take it. You know, do with it. He may go buy a sandwich with it or a drug or whatever. But he ain't gonna
I understand. Then he will come back the next day and assume that either you or somebody else will provide him the same benefit. The point over here is that long term, living on the street, being fed regularly by nice people, being handed money for booze or whatever, simply helps bring people down and make them worse and worse. And here's the thing, Sid. And as you know, my wife is a shrink. My wife's a psychologist. Right now, we have ways of treating people who are schizophrenic and delusional and deeply dysfunctional. And look, one of the horrible things, you read these stories in New York City of people pushing other people in front of subways. They're almost always homeless people with mental problems. And facilitating those mental problems is not a real benefit for this greatest nation on God's green earth.